There's no better place to lose yourself and find yourself than between the covers of a book. Hi, I'm Anne Bocock, and it's time to go between the covers. From mystery to adventure, from romance to history, I interview authors of all genres. Join me for in-depth conversations into their creative processes, their struggles, and of course, their successes. This episode was originally streamed live and includes viewer questions. Enjoy.
Mamta Chaudhry, author of Haunting Paris. Now, this is a truly original novel. It weaves the living with the dead, and as a matter of fact, one of the main characters is dead. He's a ghost. The book is also an unlikely love story, one that deals with loss and grief. And I'll tell you, page one of the book really sets the tone of the story way better than I could do this. And who better to read it to you than the author herself? Mamta, welcome to Between the Covers. And please, if you would take it from here.
Thank you, Anne. I'm just delighted to be here, virtually though it is. So I will just read the first page, as you said. You know, the first thing I always get asked is, do you believe in ghosts? Of course not. But in a city like Paris, they always keep you company. And so this is the voice I heard, and I was compelled to follow it wherever it took me. They call us revenants, those who return. Restless for this world, we pass each other in mute recognition, for to be silent and solitary is our essential condition. But death doesn't end our thirst for a human touch, a human voice calling our name. And so I haunt these familiar quays, this familiar river. Music drifts down from Sylvie's window, and I linger until it comes to an end. The scent of lilacs on the breeze stirs dormant phantoms to life, but music is sorcery more potent. Though bound to time's measure, it exists on a plane beyond time, where there is no past and no future. There is only the present, in which the dead revisit this world. Night after night, I wait until the last notes fade away and Sylvie comes to the window at last. I retreat into the shadows as one after another, the beautiful mansions along Quai d'Anjou spring to light, transforming those in the gloom below into a throng of ghosts. Occasionally, a passing figure pauses in a pool of lamplight to light a cigarette or glance at a watch. Squandered time, the most enduring of regrets. In the end, a lifetime is not enough. The heart yearns for more. Who can reason with desire? The heart has its reasons that reason cannot know.
It is so poetic. It is so lovely. And thank you for reading it. Mamta, can we talk about the choice to make the narrator a ghost, or as the Parisians, the French say, a revenant? I mean, that is not a normal, usual choice for star of the show.
Well, that is true. And I think one of the things that happened, much of the novel is set in and around Notre Dame. And, you know, I was there last year when the fire took place in the cathedral. And you can imagine it was very emotional and very intense. But right behind the soaring towers of Notre Dame, there's a memorial that sinks into the ground. It's the Memorial de la Déportation. And it's truly a very moving monument. And on the ground, chiseled in a bronze circle, are the words, they went to the end of the earth and they did not return. And then my hair stood on end as I remembered the French word for ghost, which is one who returns. And as you heard, that became the first line in the book. I think that part of what attracted me to the ghost is now that we're all in isolation, we know how one day blurs into another. And for a ghost who measures time by an unearthly calendar, the past and present blend and blur. So that gave me a way into the history of the story as well.
It is fascinating. And if I remember correctly, you should have been in Paris about now. Is that right?
Right this minute. So I would be talking to you from there.
Oh, thank you for spending it with me instead. But eventually, right this minute, you are going to give a talk in Paris.
Yes, yes, at the American Library in Paris. But, you know, we will see when that takes place. But it was a thrill to be invited to speak in Paris. You know, here's the thing. I'm clearly not French, not Jewish, neither man nor ghost. But that was the voice I heard, so I felt compelled to follow it. And I'm sure you've had other writers tell you that sometimes we don't choose our stories, sometimes they choose us. And so it was with this story. So all you can do when you're given a story is do it justice, to get it right. You know, for a long time I thought, oh, somebody's going to come to me and say, but madame, you have put this in the wrong arrondissement. If you get something wrong about Paris, a Parisian will be only too happy to point it out to you. And if it was important to get those details right, the moral responsibility to get it right for the Holocaust was much higher.
So, well, let's talk about this for a moment. The story is really told in two time periods. There is this glorious, if I get my date right, 1989, I think it is, when the French bicentennial was, Parisian bicentennial. And then it's also told in the Nazi era of World War II. And as all good stories have secrets, this has a doozy of a secret that we won't spoil. But there's history here. You talk about Notre Dame. I've been to Notre Dame several times. I never saw that memorial. I never knew this story. But can you give a little bit of this history of what happened?
Yes, and you know, it was new to me too. And it wasn't something, you know, when I started out to write this, this wasn't the story I was going to tell. I was writing about the Paris we all think of, that shimmering city of love and light and art and music. And then the city of light suddenly turned out to have very dark shadows. And you're right, 1989 is when all Paris was getting ready to celebrate the bicentennial of the French Revolution, that glorious time, well, not the time, but it gave us the glorious motto, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité. And then, while Paris is celebrating, Sylvie, pianist, is up alone in her apartment, mourning the loss of her lover, Julien. And she suddenly discovers a letter hidden in his desk. And that leads her back on a quest into Julien's past, into the dark days of the Nazi occupation, to Paris in 1942, which singularly failed to live up to its own glorious promise of liberté, égalité, fraternité. So I felt it important to juxtapose those two dates. And yes, thank you very much for not having a spoiler for the secret. You know, it doesn't matter to me with spoilers. I start reading a book and I don't know that I've read it before. And then I say, oh, this sounds familiar. But I keep reading, and with movies, but other people have sharper memories. So that's a good thing.
You mentioned Sylvie. I want to get into this because Sylvie, there is, yes, there is history. Yes, there is this secret. There is a quite unlikely love story here. Sylvie is in a, well, she is in love with The love of her life is, what, 20 some years older and married with children. So why does this work? And it did work.
Oh, I'm glad you think so. You know, one of the things is that every marriage, every love affair is opaque to an outsider. You know, you cannot quite figure out what makes it work, but you have to be able to sense the attraction and the very high stakes involved, as you said, when it's a married lover. This is a love story in which one of the lovers is dead. It is a mystery in which the detective is a pianist who is so shy that her nickname is Sylvie Latimide. It is a historical novel in which the events of the past have ominous echoes in the present, and in which the ghost is the least terrifying thing about it.
Absolutely. Yes, we love the ghost.
Well, I love the ghost too, and his voice is what came to me. So, Anne, you've been to Paris, and one of the things that I love best about going to a new city is walking around at night, looking through lighted windows, you know, imagining the lives that go on inside, like scenes in the film. And one day when I was walking on Île Saint-Louis, I heard a drift of music coming down from a lighted window. I couldn't see who was playing, but I had this really clear and vivid image of a man sitting forward and listening very intently. And I kept thinking, who is this? Why is he drawn back? And so I wrote the book to find out why Julien returns for his unfinished business on this earth.
If you are enjoying the show so far, make sure to subscribe. We post new episodes every Monday. And don't forget to leave us a review. We'd love to hear what you think. Now, back to the show.
Sylvie is a piano teacher. We're talking classical music. Music is part of the soul of Paris. Your background is music, classical music. You were the voice of classical music in the Miami area. Do you relate to her most as a character in this book?
You know, I think I relate, as one must, to all the characters because they all come out of who you are. You know, you may not be French, but you are in the sensibility of that character, even Isabelle, the wife, Julien's wife. But I'm glad you brought up music because, you know, if I had any musical talent at all, I would have wanted to be a concert pianist. But I didn't. So as a DJ on classical radio, you know, it allowed me to say, I played Mozart's 27th piano concerto. Of course, it was only a compact disc or a record in the old days. But my instrument then turns out to be language. And I really want it to capture the cadences, the rhythm of life in Paris, both the light moments and the dark moments.
So, that is your writing in a nutshell. It is inspired by music when I read it. And that is what I feel. So I'm guessing that the transition for you from music to prose was maybe not seamless, but it seemed to flow.
You know, that's so perceptive, Anne, because yes, there is a direct bridge, I think, from having a radio voice, as you did yourself too, to having a writer's voice. You just hear it in different ways. And, you know, I had always wanted to be a writer and just skirted the edges of it. And when people say, you know, this is my first published novel, not the first novel.
I was going to say, how many are in the drawer that haven't seen the light of day in a long time?
Mm-hmm. There are a lot. But, you know, every time people say, oh, this is her debut novel, I think, God, I must be the world's oldest debutante. But I think part of it, oh, no, I just read about a woman who is 80 who published her first novel. And apparently it has a lot of steamy sex in it. And I'm thinking, That's where I went wrong. You know, when people tell me 50 Shades of Grey, I think they're talking about my hair. So it is true that I went to writing, but it came from a deep love of books. All my life, I've been a bookworm. And so the transition seemed very natural to me. And in fact, I'm kind of grateful that I had to wait a very long time to get published, because it was a gift and a blessing that Nan Talese published me. She's a legendary editor, and she edited the book herself. Just with a few suggestions made it infinitely better. Okay, so many decades later, but it was worth the wait.
Right now, it doesn't just appear, because I hear this from everyone, that books and music are as important to people as maybe they have ever been, at least in our era. Why? Is it comfort? Is it escape? What do you feel?
That's interesting, because it is true that we are all turning to sources of comfort, of escape. I mean, books can transport you in a way that nothing else can. You don't need cars, you don't need planes. But I think it's more than that. I think as we are thrown back on ourselves in isolation at this moment, we kind of realize what really matters. And, you know, because I'm from India, I get asked this a lot. Are you a doctor? And I always used to say, no, I'm a DJ. Are you a doctor? So when I got my PhD from the University of Miami, now when people ask me, are you a doctor? I say, yes, actually.
Absolutely. Yes, you're a doctor.
Yeah. I don't tell them it's a doctor of literature, because I really believe that books can also cure what ails the world, to take us out of our narrow tunnel focus into a wider world, into a wider universe.
Beautifully said. Writing by nature is a solitary existence. So you, in some ways, are used to that. You don't write with a team of people. You sit and write. But has this change, this forced isolation, has it affected creativity?
Yes, it has. And not as one would expect. You go, oh, if only I had blank spaces on my calendar, I could, you know, write In Search of Lost Time, like Proust. But it doesn't work that way, because a lot of my book events got canceled from coast to coast. And, you know, I was hoping to be spreading the word about this book, which is kind of the only thing we want spreading these days. But so I have all this time, I have all this solitude, which I crave for writing, but yet it's such an unsettled time, because you don't quite know when it'll end. You know, there's, as radio people, you as a journalist and me as a writer, we thrive on deadlines. So this open-ended space sort of leaves you a little unmoored.
Not actually conducive to producing then, when you know you have an infinite amount of time.
That's exactly right. Because, you know, the work just stretches to fill the time you've allotted to it. And when that time is endless, or as far as you can see endless, then the work stretches out too. But it's my resolution to sit down and focus and work on the next book.
There are so many takeaways from Haunting Paris. I mean, book clubs are having, I'm sure, a field day with discussions. Now, this is just my perspective, and you'll tell me if you agree with me or not. I look at this as Sylvie's personal journey, and you gave the French word for her as timid. I thought she was pretty near invisible at first. Mm-hmm. She's just this little woman, little girl, little woman who nobody talks about that much. She is a piano teacher, mm-hmm. but it's her journey and her growth, and we find that this almost invisible girl manages to get the strength to go after the truth, and it's very difficult truth. Is it her journey? I mean, for me, it was.
Oh, Anne, you're an ideal reader, because that quest, that journey is a journey of growth. And, you know, Sylvie, in this very hierarchical Parisian society, she is poor, she is young, She is of no birth, no breeding, no blood. So she is easily overlooked. You know, she is a nobody. But for me, one of the things that I have always been fascinated by is courage. And I often think, as we all do, about when we read about horrific acts, when we read about the Nazis, that why didn't someone speak up? Why didn't someone say something? Were they not aware of what was going on? Or were they just frightened? And so with courage, I think the journey that Sylvie makes as somebody who is so cripplingly shy that she cannot speak up, but then she is the one person who has the moral courage to get up and say something. And, you know, much as I talk about words and cadences and poetic language and lyrical writing, someone said something to me at a book club, actually, which really struck me, that she said the three most powerful words in the whole book were three very simple words, nothing poetic about them. And the words were, shame on you. And so that really made me think.
It just gave me chills, because, and I'll tell you why. When I read it, as I said, to me, it's her journey. And then I took a step back and I thought, who would have the courage to stand up for injustice? Mm-hmm. And would I have the courage? And that gives you a lot to think about.
It really does. It really does. Because, you know, you like to think that you would have been one of the resistance and you would have been fighting underground. But now when we face injustice, when we see things happening that are absolutely unconscionable, appalling, what would it take to be the lone voice in the room to speak up? And, you know, silence is very complicated in this book. If you were one of the resistance, if you were captured, you were tortured to give up the names of other people in the cell. And so remaining silent was an act of great courage. But in other circumstances, it was an act of complicity. So one of the things, you know, when you say about whom do you relate to, whom I aspire to, is people who were called the righteous among nations, those who spoke up for the Jews in Paris at this time, because this is what I was writing about, but it applies, you know, universally and for all time. They spoke up at great danger to their own lives and with no hope of reward. I hope we could be that, but I fear that we may not have that courage.
I don't know if you wrote this as a cautionary tale, but it could be interpreted that way.
I did not. When I was writing it, what I was writing, I thought, was safely in the past. But as William Faulkner says, the past is never dead. It's not even past. And, you know, the echoes that arise now when we see what's going on all around us, it is a cautionary tale. It is a reminder that those who forget the past are not only condemned to repeat it themselves, but they doom us all with their forgetfulness of where this can lead.
I would love to take the remaining minutes we have and talk about something pleasant here, and that's the city of Paris, because Paris is as vital a character in this book as any of the characters in this book, and you spend so much time there. To me, it's a city that you were meant just to wander and lose yourself in, alleyways and little markets. And what are some of your favorites?
Well, it's true that this is a love letter to Paris. You know, it's not the kind of funny Valentine that Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris is, which is just a lovely, charming film. But it is a love letter that's filled with heartbreak and sorrow as much as real love can be. But you're right about Paris being a city made for flânerie, you know, for wandering wherever your fancy takes you. And for me, that's always by the river, by its beautiful panoply of bridges, and most of all, by Île Saint-Louis.
Love it. Monty, we do have a question, and it's from your friend Betty, who happens to be in Italy. She said it's a technical question. Betty wants to know, how do you decide on the length of the book?
Betty and I were in Calcutta together during our college days, so our friendship goes back a long, long way. And even though we live in very different continents now, we've kept in touch. So Betty, about the length of the book, you know, I think it was dictated by the story itself. And what happened, I told you about Nan's edits. She came up with a couple of things, which meant that I had to slice out about a third of the book and come back and rewrite it to her suggestion. And I thought, this won't work, but it did. And it just happened. I don't write long. I write very compressed. You know, I write long, but then I cut it, cut into a compressed, edited whole that I want to convey all the emotion and intensity of it without going on a bit.
And Mamta, first of all, Haunting Paris is moving. It is at times intense, as well as a love letter, and lyrical. Above all, it is lyrical. And it could only be written by someone who loves the City of Light as much as you do. Thank you for that. Mamta Chaudhry, this has been so much fun. Thank you for sharing your story.
I'm Anne Bocock, and thank you for listening to Go Between the Covers, produced by South Florida PBS. To stay connected with us and our guests, check out our show notes or visit us at southfloridapbs.org/goBTC. Next Monday, award-winning author Edwidge Danticat, who has been called one of the greatest writers of our time, joins us to discuss her latest collection of short stories, Everything Inside. Don't miss it.